This is CliffCentral.com.
A very, very hearty welcome to all our special listeners, both in South Africa and around what Carl Sagan would have dubbed the pale blue dot. I think it's awesome to be here today at CliffCentral.com, and you are listening to Professor David Block, and we're going to be looking up in wonder, as we always do each week. We look up in wonder at the awe, at the majesty, at the grandeur, at the splendor of our cosmos above. But what is so interesting is that the cosmos not only exists in the macrocosm, the large, the big, the inextricably large, but as Blaise Pascal once said, the heart has its reasons that reason knows not of. And so today, we're going to be taking a very special walk down memory lane. And our title today, Duncan, is entitled Astronomy and Poetry. How does that grab you, Duncan? From the very big to what's in the heart and in the head, astronomy and poetry.
Everything is connected, Professor. Looking
I love that. You see, Duncan just spurs me on. Everything is connected. So if you want to reach us in studio, you dial 0861-555-189. That's 0861-555-189. The Twitter handle at CliffCentral.com. Facebook, Cliff Central. But the most popular way of reaching us is WeChat, and the WeChat ID is Cliff Central. My Twitter handle is at Starry Galaxy Man. My webpage is www.davidblock.co.za. Now, today we have very special guests with us. In particular, we have a professor who's driven all the way from Potchefstroom to be with us here today. And it's a tremendous joy and a singular honor to welcome you, Helena de Plooy, professor at the Northwest University, to our studios here in Rivonia. It really is a tremendous joy to have you with us.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody.
And also, we're joined by a dear friend of mine, and we go back many, many years, Duncan, when I had brown hair, not gray hair. And and so his name is Davette Ferreira. And Davette, we're just thrilled to also have you on board at short notice, but it's good to have you on board.
Thank you, David. Great honor being here.
So today, our theme is entitled Astronomy and Poetry. A few years ago, just to set this theme, but a few years ago, Duncan, I learnt of a professor, T.T. Clutter, and somebody told me that he wrote the most incredible poetry linking the big with the small, and that he was very, very interested in astronomy. And so eventually, I reached, now, oh, yes, I remember. I reached Teresa, is it Papenpuss, Helena?
Yes, that's right.
And she recommended that I contact you, and I then met the legendary T.T. Clutter, who has now passed on at the age of 91. But I would say that there's no greater living expert on this planet in his poetry, in the poetry and in the legacy of the giant T.T. Clutter than Helena de Plooy. She's certainly held in the absolute highest esteem by the late T.T. Clutter himself. I remember before she stepped into his lounge, he was chatting to me, and it was clearly obvious to me just the esteem in which he held Professor de Plooy. And in fact, just before he died, he invited me to lunch, and he said, please join Helena and I for lunch or for dinner. I still have that WhatsApp. So here was a legendary giant, and I'd like you, Helena, to please commence the journey down space and down time of perhaps one of your favorite poems of his, which you have translated into English. But firstly, how did you meet T.T. Clutter?
Yes, I did not meet him as an undergraduate student.
Yes.
When I studied in Potch, he was in for 5 years in Port Elizabeth.
Yes.
But when I started with my doctoral studies, I went to see him because he was professor of what we call in Afrikaans literatuurwetenskap, which is actually the theory and philosophy of literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more my interest.
Yes.
So he was actually the promoter of my PhD. Well, I got a D.Lit at that time. That was what you got.
And
for
what
the
was
work.
That on?
Well, actually, it was on narrative theory. What we call narratology.
Yes.
It was not about poetry.
I see. Okay. And what was your first impressions of the giant T.T. Clute himself? I mean, he was obviously a large man, a towering man. What impressed me was his physical physique and yet his gentle spirit. What attracted you to the giant T.T. Clute?
Yes. I think two things. The first is that he's really a very warm and friendly person.
He wasn't he?
Yeah, he always got along excellently with the students. He was a very charismatic mm-hmm. lecturer.
Yes.
But then on the other hand, I think what attracted me as well was his clarity of mind, his questing spirit.
Yes.
You know, one of his volumes of poetry is called Holy Curiosity.
Oh, which wonderful. That's beautiful. Holy Curiosity.
And I think he got the concept from Einstein.
Mm.
And I think that's what kept him going, because he never thought he was going to get this old, but that questing spirit kept him going.
Mm. Yeah. But of course, what's very interesting, isn't it, Devet, is that holy curiosity, you've got the curiosity, but in a sense, you know, Einstein is reported to have said, you know, I want to know God's thoughts, the rest are details. The sort of endeavor that I'm involved in as a professor of astronomy and applied maths is a holy vocation. It's dealing with the book of nature. And in your studies, does that also resonate with what you've discovered and discussed in your field?
Yes, I think, I'm thinking about what you did about with galaxies and so.
Yes.
And the creativity took.
Yes.
And I'm always reminded, I've met many other astronomers besides you, but you are really given to the creativity aspect of it.
Yes, I love that.
And you love the graphical mm-hmm. and the almost poetical aspect of your astronomy.
Yes,
I think people don't think first of all, except that you were fellow of the Royal Society at, 17? But
90,
people don't think of you mm-hmm. as a man of mathematics mm-hmm. first, even though mm-hmm. you are.
Mm-hmm.
They think of you in a creative way and mm-hmm. with graphics. And so, yes, I fully agree with mm-hmm. you.
Helner, of course, you know, people would put science in one department and poetry and art and literature in another department. But I like to marry them, as Devetta said. I think creativity is awesome. I think it's just so wonderful, you know, to be delved into, you know, relativistic astrophysics on the one hand and the mathematics of the universe and the birth of galaxies and the death of galaxies and so on. And then on the other hand, to be thinking about the broken in heart and Pascal's great, you know, emphasis on the heart, having its reasons which reason knows not of. Don't you long for the day when more people like T.T. Clute would write about the inextricable marriage between the sciences and the arts?
Yeah, I think that is a very wonderful thing. Excuse me. And I think that Clute was actually one of the people who not only professed that, but actually did that. You know, he practiced that. This whole thing of bringing scientific knowledge into his poetry.
Yes.
And presenting it in a creative and lovely way. Because poetry has the ability, because of the way in which language is used in poetry,
mm-hmm.
to sort of expand meaning.
Right.
You don't have a sort of a scientific one-to-one relation between words
there's
and meanings.
There's an openness, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, it knocks it open, mm-hmm. actually. And telescopes it, you know. It becomes
There we go.
Yeah.
Now you're speaking my language, Helen.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that is actually what he did.
Oh, I love that. It telescopes it, listeners.
Yeah. You know, his last book that was published not his last book of poetry, but a book of prose, is called The Other One Is Me, or The Other One Is Myself.
Uh-huh.
And that, I would actually call that his magnum opus.
Really? Tell me about that book. Tell us about that book.
Yeah, and what he did, it's a marvelous book. I can't really put it into a genre.
Yes.
Because he took autobiographical details from his own life,
mm-hmm.
but then he philosophizes about it, about that issue, scientifically,
mm-hmm.
and he puts all his knowledge, mm-hmm. his scientific knowledge, his psychological knowledge, all these things, he integrated it all in this book.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, at this point in time, it's only available in Afrikaans, you know.
So now it says the ander een is ek. So who's the other one? I mean, the other one is me,
yeah.
but who's the other one, if you say the ander een?
That actually means that we are all one.
I see.
Everything is connected, like he said.
I see. As Duncan said, everything's
yeah.
connected. So I'd love you. I mean, I just adored. I was invited, listeners, to now listen to this. This is just, you know, there's a society called the, is it the Maria van Riebeek Club or the?
Yeah.
Is it? Is
yeah,
that right?
I think so.
And so I was invited to speak, Duncan, to the Marias. You must remember this. Here's this professor, gray hair. Not much money in the bank. And here come these Mercedes-Benz and just, you know, ladies dripping in jewelry. And they just, you know, and it's just was so awesome. And so I'm sitting at the main table because I'm the speaker. And I put up a poem and I said, who wrote this poem? Now, I mean, if anybody should know, it's the Marias. And so I put up a poem called Eight Fra Roop. And I put it up and I read it. And not one person knew it was written by T.T. Clutter. But this poem really grabbed my attention. And I would love you to read it, perhaps in Afrikaans and in English, because it's just, that is to me, just one of the gems of his writings.
Yeah.
Hail now.
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't have the Afrikaans version here now.
Okay.
But I can read the English
Please
translation.
Do.
I translated the Uit Vra Roep,
yes.
which Uit Vra means when you question somebody.
Okay, questioning,
but
yes.
But it's more intense than just asking.
Yes.
And then Roep is, of course, an exclamation or calling out.
Like almost an echo or calling out, yes.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. I translated that as questioning exclamation.
Wonderful. Oh, I think that's awesome, don't you, Duncan?
Absolutely.
Questioning, but it's more than questioning. Questioning with a resonating note. Questioning with a question mark. Yes,
yeah.
Exclamation. Wonderful.
Yeah, and it goes like this. You cast forth planets and displace galaxies. What does leprosy mean to you or an aching pinky before your almighty power? You measure light years and remember eternity. You must indeed also know about me and reckon with me. You are indeed also mindful of me.
You know, I just love that. Let me just hold that in my hands, if I may, please, because I just think that's just an awesome translation. I, of course, have read it in Afrikaans, and it really is just so amazing. But, Yvette, what strikes you about this ending? You know, you also, you are, is toch ook op mij bedacht, is ook, yes, you are indeed also so mindful of me. I mean, isn't that a beautiful, you know, you've got the juxtaposition of casting forth the planets, displacing the galaxies, then bringing in leprosy. What does this say to your heart, David?
Well, it goes to the humanity of it. And
yes, it does, doesn't it?
It starts with the largest scale and then goes to the smallest and
mm-hmm.
thus juxtaposition.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Can I ask, Helena, what's the significance of leprosy there?
Yes, that's a good question.
Yeah, I think it has to do, it is a physical illness, but it is also the illness with a bad stigma. It used to be traditionally was seen as something that was incurable,
mm-hmm. and it was a stigma too.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. and you were isolated. I mean, so that is actually almost as if it's the worst illness that you can have.
Oh.
And even you know, then you think, you know, what can this? This is so small, you know. If I have this, I am so small, and I have this.
And
very,
I'm an outcast.
Yes, I'm an outcast. I think that is the thing. But then God will also know about you.
So in other words, there's an David. What I read into this is, and Helena can correct us because I'm not a professor of this at all. I'm a professor of astronomy and applied mathematics and relativistic astrophysics and so on. But David, I think that, and you can ask more, please, is that, you know, in other words, God who casts forth the galaxies and the stars and the planets, you know, he's aware of the leper. Does this not go to the heart of the Gospels? Is that, you know, who touched me? You know, the outcasts being included. I think that's an incredible way of putting it.
Yes, certainly. And I think, if I might ask, we kind of hit the ground running here. And it's a very fascinating angle from going to the universe and all that. And,
yes.
But Helena, if people wonder there, who was this Titi Klute?
Yes.
As a person, who was he? Paint a picture like Stephen Hawking wrote A Brief History of Time. So A Brief History of Titi Klute, how would you describe the man, the presence?
Yeah, he had an exceptional life, actually. he always thought, he was very humble about his beginnings. He was born in the Vredefort Dome on a farm of very ordinary parents.
And of course, he wrote a poem about that, and that's where the comet or the meteorite hit.
That's right.
Billions of years ago.
Yes, and later on, when he sort of rethought that, he wrote this lovely poem, Coming Home. Can I read that?
Yes, of course you may.
Because it says.
No, I think
it
it's
says
lovely.
A lot.
It paints a picture for our listeners of his origins.
He says, "I grew up on a seemingly God-forsaken fortress of peace, a Vredefort. I must have known from birth what later on I would discover, that I was living on the dome of a miracle. That anybody could have thought that it was not exceptional, that the hills were there merely for climbing and the water of the Vaal merely for swimming and catching yellowfish. Forgive the cliché. In this crescent of hills, curved like rippling water around a granite bubble from west to east, there, up to this day, the Creator is visibly near, having poked the place in times earlier than early with an enormous finger."
And I think, David, once again, this is this beauty of the large and the small.
Because
here you have Vredefort, right where we live, one of the largest impact craters on Earth.
Right.
And this humanity coming in there.
Right.
Yeah. but when he had finished his high school training.
So that was in Krugersdorp, where we come from, Duncan.
Yeah.
You know, with the two of us are coming from Krugersdorp, Mogale City.
That's here. where he matriculated. And then he went to Pretoria University to study theology. But at the end of his first year, he contracted polio. And he had to spend the next 2 years in bed. And he was...
The next 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. And he was actually quite handicapped after that. You know, it affected his back and his legs, and he walked with great difficulty. When he resumed his studies in, I think, 1945, he went to university in a wheelchair. But it became better, and he could sort of, you know, move about. And then, of course, he studied literature, and he went to the Netherlands, where he did his doctoral studies under Van Wyk Loo. And he came back, and he became professor of Afrikaans literature and literary theory. And he was writing all the time, but he said he was in awe of the great figures of Afrikaans literature, N.P. Van Wyk Loo and De Opperman. And he thought, well, what could I, you know, what can I contribute?
Sure.
But because of the polio, he would, in cycles of more or less 5 or 6 years, he would become very ill with a sort of a rheumatism-like illness, you know,
like affecting all the arthritis.
Yeah, with all the nerve ends being inflamed
and so on,
and it's very
like
painful.
A shingles type,
yeah, and then his wife once said to him, you know. And he was very despondent, and he thought he wasn't going to get well. And his wife said, no, what am I going to do with all those drawers full of poetry? Please take some of those poems and edit them, you know, give them a final editing so that they can be published. And when that manuscript was reviewed by D. Opperman, he called it Food for Kings. And I mean, the rest is history. Because in the end, he published 10 volumes of poetry.
Was it 10 in total? Yes.
10, and they're very thick. They're not these very slim little volumes of poetry. They're sort of substantial ones, all of them. Yeah.
And can you tell me, I mean, apart from the students whose hearts he touched deeply, did he touch the minds of sort of some of the great thinkers, say, in science as well, say, in Potchefstroom and further afield? Because I'm so interested in the science-art connection. And just like his poetry appealed to me so much because of that, are you aware that this has, or is it more limited because his Afrikaans, his poetry is limited to Afrikaans in a sense, and is only now recently being translated more into English?
Yeah. Well, he had a lot of contact with his colleagues on campus.
Yes.
And his one son is also a scientist.
I see.
And I know that another friend of ours, who is at this point in time the dean of the faculty of science at our university.
Yes.
He remembers since they were young, they had these conversations and arguments with him, you know, about science.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's just so interesting, Duncan. I must read you something and then you can tell me, Duncan. He opened this book, the legendary T.T. Clutter, opened this book and he said to me, Prof, can you please tell me who wrote these words? So this is from one of his volumes, and so I'll just read it to you, Duncan, and you can tell me if any names spring to mind. I gave one or two guesses, but I certainly didn't know. It reads, and I quote, "I sincerely believe that the universe is as vast as it is, so that we might indeed search for its creator."
Professor, I don't know who comes up to mind. I'm thinking maybe a painter. Is it a painter?
It could be. Who would you think? Van Gogh? Or?
It must be Van Gogh.
You think?
Could it be the same guy who said the mind is an empty vessel?
That is Plutarch.
Was it Plutarch?
Wonderful. See, I'm sitting next to a legend here in his own right, Duncan. Plutarch said, "The mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lit up. Oh, yes, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lit. Well, Duncan, you tell the listeners who wrote this.
Oh, you wrote this, Professor.
I don't remember that, but he chuckled so hard. Why don't you tell the listeners about how he chuckled? I mean, this was for me one of the most embarrassing moments of my life.
Yeah, he enjoyed it so much, you know, that he could say, well, you wrote that.
Just read it again, please, Professor. Please.
You wanted me to read it again, please. With pleasure. But I didn't even know that I'd written it. I have written it, of course, in one of my books. But I suppose it's a question that us profs write and write and write, and we forget what we've said. But, David, you'll remember my book, Our Universe, Accident or Design, yes?
Yes, yes.
And there were two Nobel Prize winners who wrote the preface. And it reads, "I sincerely believe..." Well, yes, I'll let David read it. I shouldn't be reading my own... I shouldn't be reading my own poetry, so...
Okay,
Let's see what's happening here.
"I sincerely believe that the universe, as vast as it is... So that we might indeed search for its creator." Sorry, I left out the "is." "Is as vast as it is, so that we might indeed search for its creator."
It is. It's just this juxtaposition between the very, very big and the very, very small. But then, Helena, over just a brief chat before we came on air, you were telling me of a wonderful poem that he wrote, which was describing a woman by means of a line. I found that very interesting. It's a whole poem, listeners, and what he's actually gone and done is he's actually describing a woman, but in terms of line or linear form, which is very, very hard to do because, as you know, when you're drawing linearly, you're drawing, say, in a two-dimensional plane, and here he's trying to describe a three-dimensional object. Imagine describing your beloved, Duncan, in terms of a line. That's hard to do, yes?
Definitely, because there's nothing much more to a line. It's just straight.
That's right. I mean, you would say so. You would say there's a pencil and there's a line and there's nothing more to it, but it's absolutely just straight. And yet this legendary giant, T.T. Clutter, actually juxtaposed. I mean, that's why I've called today's crossing Astronomy and Poetry, because he was just so immersed in the depths of cosmic space and of cosmic time, and yet he was immersed in humanity, and that's what I find so fascinating. Why don't you read us some stanzas, please, Helena, of that poem?
All right. The poem is called Silhouette of Beatrice, and that is, of course, the Beatrice who was the idealized beloved of Dante.
Dante, yes.
And when they entered, in the third book, when they enter the heavens, they see that all shapes and forms are round and rounded and curved.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole poem is actually about the curve, and mm-hmm. it goes like this. Frontally from the forehead, the curve slips into the refined tilt of the tip of the nose, turns back and up again softly into the arching upper lip. With a wavelet swell, the lower lip dives deeply back to the dimpled chin and the rounded jaw. An urn is the throat. Languidly from there, the chest reaches out to the delicate tip and turns inward over the belly, alluring and shy. The line sweeps down the long thigh in a gentle curve that slowly stretches and folds into the soft orb of the knee, moves back and becomes the elongated shin, sloping earthwards in the arched bridge of the foot.
I just think, I mean, Duncan, when you listen to those words, don't you see the foot in front of you? Don't you see the nose? Don't you see the chin? Don't you see the neck? I mean, it's extraordinary when you think of it, the power of the word, is it not?
Great imagery there, Professor.
Oh, there you go. That's my language. Great imagery there. David, what strikes you about that poem? Because, of course, you're a great follower of Dante and lover of Dante's work too.
Yes, I just the way he studied him and... Yeah, just it's just simple and beautiful.
Yes.
You know, just takes together everything.
But I think what's so interesting, and I mean, this is really why I suppose I found such a resonance with him. I just wish I had more time to have spent with him. But the point was that there was always the humanity. I mean, I suppose that's what's, as you know from my many lectures, is that we study the universe of the large, but then through the anthropic principle, we study the universe of the very small and humanity and the fine tunings of the universe. And he sees a very beautiful, deep harmony between the scientific universe and between, you know, emotion and the heart and feeling and depth and wonder and awe and majesty and so forth. And I think he's quite unique in that respect of bringing this out. Helena.
Yes, I can only answer by reading another poem.
Please do.
The poem is called About Him and Me.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes like this. He who extends the heavens and hides suns behind suns, in vast spaces that dwarf the earth, who stirs the seas with his exciting feet, and peeps into mountains and the chambers of the south. He curved the heavens and the earth thinking about me, and the blended colors in my encompassing, far-reaching eye. He created an enormous glory which from the soil to the dome can be accommodated within the small resonant cavity of my mouth.
I must congratulate you for that exceptional translation. And I just want to reread it again for myself. And I know the listeners will just love it too. I think Helena just read it so beautifully. But I'll just read one or two little stanzas. He who extends. I mean, you've got the sweeping, the vast. He who extends the heavens and hides suns behind suns. The starry vaults, De Wet, of the Via Lactea or the Milky Way. But let me put words into his. He who extends the heavens and hides suns behind suns in vast spaces that dwarf the earth, who stirs the seas with his exciting feet and peeps into mountains and the chambers of the south. He curved the heavens and the earth, thinking about me. I think one's got such a beautiful juxtaposition there of Einstein's mind, really. You know, he's not speaking of the heavens being flat, as in the essay, possible in an Aristotelian sense, but he's thinking of the heavens as being curved. I think that's a very nice little peep, as it were, not only into the giant mind of T.T. Clutter, but also a little peep into what Einstein had to say about the heavens.
Yes, I definitely think next time you talk about general relativity to your class, you should talk about the curved heavens from that poem there.
Well, I just think it's so beautiful that, in other words, the cosmos is made for a purpose. Helena, tell me, did T.T. Clutter always see that? To him, was the snowflake one of purpose? Was, you know, the tiny little daisy or cosmos? I don't know which flower you have in Potchefstroom that's particularly beautiful, but I know here we have the cosmos flowers. Was that part and parcel of T.T. Clutter?
Yeah. I think the whole idea of relations between things or even among things. And you either have that in the sense of a correspondence, that the small thing also looks like the big thing.
Yes, I noticed that.
And then on the other hand, the juxtaposition, that you can sort of contrast these things with one another.
Yes.
And you just find it in almost in all his poems. You know, there's another one which was translated beautifully by Michiel Haynes. And it's about, he describes himself sitting in his garden writing a letter to somebody for a birthday, and it goes like this.
Yes.
I'm sitting here in the garden writing to you. How festive the everyday can be.
Yes.
The trees stand sheltering around me. There are lilies in the ponds.
Yes.
Lovely little weaver wonder workers build nests right in front of me over the water. How very small can what's festive be?
Yes.
But then he goes on and it becomes more and more, and he talks about the sun.
Yes.
He says, even though the sun, like us, has passed his middle years.
Yes.
You know? And so always this, the smallness, the locality of I am being here.
Yes.
But I am in contact with what is very large.
Wonderful.
And I am part of this bigness.
I think that's beautiful, this interconnectedness. So I'm just looking on Wiki. Duncan's brought up. Duncan's my right-hand man, listeners, as you know. And so I'm just looking at some of the prizes he's won. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. In 1980, the Ingrid Jonker Prize for poesy. Then he wins the Hofmeyr Prize for poetry. Then in 1983, the Louis Leight Prize, the CNA Prize. Then the Hofmeyr Prize again in 1986. It just goes on and on. The Herzog Prize for poetry. But I want to see that question. And then the Andrew Murray Prize, of course. Duncan, there was a question on WeChat which came up. Oh, thank you. So, Nathan, a hearty welcome to you. We always enjoy and feast upon people like yourselves, true jewels who follow our feed so faithfully. You're just a great guy, Duncan. Yep. Nathan. Yes, and Duncan. Now, Nathan says, beautiful poems. Sad that we don't learn about local great poets at school. Majestic poetry. Prof, what do you think he was trying to achieve globally in all of his writings? Well, I'll give you my thoughts, but, you know, really, I have to say today that I'm standing on the giant shoulders of Heinlein de Ploy, because this is her domain totally. I mean, I'm just a tremendous admirer of T.T. Clutter. But, Helena, how would you answer that, Prof? What do you think T.T. was trying to achieve in his writings? What was the reason for this poetry?
I think he wanted to show that there are grand concepts, metaphysical ideas which underlie the existence of human beings. But I think he saw his task as trying to put that into language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that resonant cavity of his mouth, it brings it back to language. What can you do with, you know, with it in language?
Mm.
Because language communicates, well, across time, across many boundaries. Well, of course, if it's translated.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he wanted to understand what lies beneath the surface of what we see in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting, you know, if you had to perhaps ask me, Nathan, in general, I suppose I see people living behind worlds of masks, don't I, Duncan?
All the time.
All the time. People who are not really perhaps aware of the grand concepts, and people who are perhaps being too narrow-minded in their thought processes and neurophysiological processing. But I think Titi Klutu was a man who, especially in his last book, that one you've just mentioned, Helena, has tried to unmask, if we, in a sense, I dare not say this in an irreligious sense, but he tries to almost unmask, not God himself, because that is impossible. He tries to unmask the mystery behind us all and tries to get us to peak, perhaps, as in Psalm 8 and in Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. In other words, he's trying, perhaps by means of his poetry, to unmask the greater mystery. Would that be correct, Helena?
Yeah, I think so. I think he wanted to make people aware of mm-hmm. this, of the wonder that is in all things.
Mm.
The smallest thing, mm-hmm. the little birds, the smallest flower, a grain of sand, but also the cosmos.
Mm. Now, of course, you know, one thing that just crossed my mind is that if you Wiki or Google or whatever you need to do, Kepler snowflake, then you'll see that Kepler, of course, wrote a very famous book on the treatise of the snowflake. And the story is that Kepler was walking on across a bridge in Prague, and a little snowflake fell on his coat. It was very cold. It was wintertime near Christmas. And he wrote, he didn't write a poem about the poet of the snowflake, but he actually wrote a beautiful book, a treatise. Yes, there we are. It's called, that's right, On the Six-Cornered Snowflake, the work of Kepler. And it's a classic. I mean, now, I know that Titi Klutu also was intrigued by snowflakes, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember the last time that I asked him to come and talk to the honors students.
Mm-hmm.
He was then sort of newly obsessed by something that's got six corners.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought the most beautiful PowerPoint pictures along, which he showed to the students. And he said, well, for instance, when in a beehive,
mm-hmm.
you can't have a square.
Mm-hmm,
because it would sort of drop out, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. you can't have a triangle because it mm-hmm. can't keep its content.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have the hexagon,
with the six
sides and so
mm-hmm.
on,
mm-hmm.
that can sort of hold the honey.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had a whole series of other pictures mm-hmm. of how many things depend on that principle of six flowers mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. stems, and you
and
know, and he had all these yes. all these visual things.
Yes,
that was something that I mm-hmm. admired him for so tremendously, because I've always asked him to come and talk to the students, and very mm-hmm. often we also had him at the in the courses for the students for creative writing.
Mm.
And he would always prepare meticulously
mm.
and come with a whole PowerPoint thing with lots of information.
Oh, really?
And a well-structured lecture. You know, mm. it was he was really, he was a great intellectual.
Mm.
Absolutely.
You know, I just got in front of me. I'm reminded of Kepler's words, "Nix," Latin for nothing, and Kepler never ever considered the snowflake to be nothing. He didn't even consider the smallest particle of dust to be nothing. He said, no, there is just such mystery and awe. And there's actually an interesting story, you know, Duncan, because his patron wasn't paying him too well, or forgot to pay Kepler. And so Kepler worked as imperial astronomer, of course, for Emperor Rudolf II, and the emperor had other things on his mind and forgot to pay him, and so the best gift Kepler could give him for Christmas was this lecture. It's an incredible book to actually peruse. But we are paying homage and tribute to the legendary T.T. Clutter. Our time is well flying by. It's just incredible how in these 45 minutes we can touch on so much. But it's interesting that here you've got the giant Kepler just in awe of the snowflake, and you've got the giant T.T. Clutter, South African born, South African raised, proudly walked South African soils, was extremely proud of his Afrikaans heritage, and who just brought great honor to us all. I just want to today really salute the legendary T.T. Clutter. Now, there is a book, Halner, you wanted to tell our listeners the title thereof so that they can go out and order this book.
Yes, it's a book of contemporary Afrikaans poetry in translation. Mm-hmm. The poems were selected from volumes that appeared between 2005 and 2011. Mm-hmm. The title is In a Burning Sea. Mm-hmm. And the editor was Marlise Joubert. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful book. It's a thick book with the Afrikaans poem on one side and the English poem on the other side. And I think especially for South African English-speaking people, it would be a very good introduction to Afrikaans poetry.
Mm. You know, De Wet, in closing, you, of course, have followed my career in cosmic dust so much. And I just love the way T.T. Clutter ends off this poem about him and me. He created an enormous glory from which from the soil to the dome can be accommodated within the smallest resonant cavity of my mouth. Doesn't that bring to fore much of the work we've done over the years of, you know, cosmic stardust, and he made us from the dust of the earth?
Yes, definitely. The greatest and the smallest. And I think what's fascinating about that poem is both the transcendence and the immanence.
Now, that's beautiful.
Because you read about God's feet excitedly. So the almost the personhood of God, and yet the great majesty is on the largest scales, the transcendence. Mm-hmm. So it's once again awesome how he brings these together. Mm-hmm. And
So I think that's a lovely note to end off with. We've been having the singular joy and pleasure of interviewing Professor Halner Duploy. I'm from Parch, and it's just been an absolute honor, and to do this to my friend, even though I just wished I had known him even yet more, T.T. Clutter, but Halner had worked with him for a great number of years, and also De Wet Ferreira, my dear friend from Pretoria. I think it's just awesome that here we can have a global live feed, a live global feed around the world, honoring this giant of a man. If you're interested in any of his poetry, some of it has been translated into English. If you read Afrikaans, of course, then it becomes a lot easier. Do buy the book In a Burning Sea, edited or by Joubert. And I think that the key thought to end on is this. God is not only transcendent over his creation, which means above and beyond his creation, but I suppose in John chapter 1, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. You sense his eminence. In other words, he comes out of space and time. As Chesterton said, Gloria in profundis Deo. Gloria in profundis Deo. That would be glory to God in the lowest. And I suppose that that would be a very fitting ending to probing the majestic mindset of a person whom I admire deeply, of a man who lived to the ripe old age of 91, of a man who inspired David Block to look up in awe and in wonder. Thank you so much to our studio guests. And until next week, this is Professor David Block looking up in wonder, signing out. CliffCentral.com.
It's back, the Botswana Annual International Music Festival. It's all happening on Saturday, the 5th of September, 2015, in Gaborone. Featuring Mafikizolo, Kulichana, Japraza, Zeus, Charmer Girl, MMP Family, Eskimos, Crispin the Drummer, Lizibo, and many more, including me, Gareth Cliff. Get your tickets online at www.webtickets.co.bw. Join us. Let's go partying in Botswana, Saturday, the 5th of September, 2015. Make it a date. Don't be late.
This is CliffCentral.com.